The Middle Ages, Part 1, the third talk in a series entitled Church History, was presented by Peter Waringa on April 17, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center and Institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. I provided some notes for you, an outline. As I told Jody a minute ago, when I reduced it to an outline, I realized how little I really have to say and how much time I take to say it. So you're going to have to bear with me. Today, we're going to be finishing up the third page of the outline and starting on the fourth and fifth pages. And in theory, this week and next week, we will finish all of that outline, and then I'll have another one for you in a couple weeks. Before we get started tonight, I wanted to just ask how many of you, if any of you, have read Augustine's Confessions. Just a little show of hands, a couple people. Okay.
Partial credit.
Partial credit. I read Augustine's Confessions when I was in college, I'm guessing. And for me, it just had a tremendous impact on my life. When we first had the first class a couple weeks ago, I told you folks that you would be getting from me a very personal look at church history. You'd be getting it through my eyes. Well, Augustine has become for me a friend, something of a spiritual mentor. So he's one of those guys that I'm very protective of. I don't like people to say bad things about Augustine. That's my shortcoming as a historian. That's why I'd never make it in the big leagues of being a historian, because people I really like, and not uncommonly, I will be looking for reasons to like them and be very defensive of them. But Augustine, especially in his Confessions, for me, he gives us a picture of a man who everybody acknowledges he was one of the most brilliant men of Western civilization, just an unbelievable intellect. But at the same time, what you see in the Confessions is a man who is tremendously humble, tremendously open. You get a picture of a guy, warts and all, I mean, just a very clear picture of who he is, with all of his shortcomings, all of his failures. And I like that. I like seeing someone, or I like hearing someone like that, who is comfortable enough with what God is doing in his life, what God has done in his life, is comfortable enough to be able to give that picture of himself. So you see that in Augustine's Confessions. And I wanted to start off this evening just by, we're going to read over the course of the talk tonight, we're going to read two sections, short sections out of Augustine's Confessions. And I'll just start off with the very first section, Book 1, Chapter 1, the very first paragraph. And sometimes with Augustine, you have to look beyond some of the flowery language. He doesn't speak the way we're used to speaking these days. But listen to what he has to say. Listen to what he's trying to communicate here. This is the very first section of his Confessions. He says, "Can any praise be worthy of the Lord's majesty? How magnificent his strength! How inscrutable his wisdom! Man is one of your creatures, Lord, and his instinct is to praise you. He bears about him the mark of death, the sign of his own sin, to remind him that you thwart the proud. But still, since he is part of your creation, he wishes to praise you. The thought of you stirs him so deeply that he cannot be content unless he praises you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you." That last line there, You made us for yourself, and your hearts and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you. For me, many years ago, as a college student, was just a very powerful expression of what was going on in my life, of what I was experiencing at that time, in having a desire to know God, to follow God, that I just didn't find rest. I didn't find peace anywhere else. And so for me, Augustine has always been someone that has really resonated with me. Well, we're going to wrap up tonight. We're going to wrap up our discussion of the Church Fathers. I view Augustine as something of a bridge between the early years of the Church Fathers, if you will, the first 300-400 years of the Church, and the Middle Ages. So he's the last of the Church Fathers in the beginning of the Middle Ages. These are just a couple of names I'm going to throw out for you, just of other theologians, other Church Fathers that we really don't need to go into a lot of depth talking about before we get to Augustine. But I've got them there in your outline. The great Cappadocians were three individuals who were part of the church in the East at this point, and they were known in the history of the church. They were known as theologians who were fighting for the defense of the Orthodox view of the Trinity. And this is a theme that we're going to see throughout this lecture. And I think it's a very prevalent theme in church history that for the church in the East, they continued for hundreds of years to be struggling with the whole question of the nature of the Trinity. When we talked about it last week, when we talked about the Trinitarian controversy, I tried to communicate that even though it was supposedly settled at the Council of Nicaea in 325, even though that was supposed to settle the issue, the reality was that for the next 50 years, nobody was sure which way the church would go with regard to the Arian position or with regard to what came to be known as the Orthodox position. For a long time, it was really up in the air as to which position was going to be the one that was preeminent in the church. And it depended often on who was in power, on who the emperor was, and which way the emperor leaned. And for Constantine himself, he would lean one way for a while, and then he'd go back the other way. We talked about how Athanasius, who had been the champion of the Orthodox position, the champion of the Nicene creedal position, how Athanasius, over the course of his life, was in and out of exile five times because his position was in and out of favor five times. Well, for the next, like I said, 50 years, it was up in the air as to which position would actually win out. And the different emperors had different positions. Now, over the course of today's lecture, we're going to run into some interesting names of people. I love the way folks end up being named throughout history. You'll have Gregory the Great and that sort of thing. Well, one of the emperors in the East, one of the emperors who lived about 30, 40, 50 years after Constantine was Julian the Apostate. Now, how'd you like to go down in history with that name? Julian the Apostate. Well, he got that name because not only did he not accept the Arian position, he didn't accept the Orthodox position. He thought it was time to get rid of the Christians altogether and to go back to worshiping the Roman gods and to go back to the old way of doing things. So he wasn't around for very long, but needless to say, during this time, there was still tremendous controversy in the East, primarily about the whole Trinitarian issue. And that would go on in the East for several hundred more years. In the West, it wasn't as big an issue. In the West, we'll find as we look at things that they were concerned with a lot of other things. The Trinitarian controversy was not at the forefront of the things that they were dealing with. But here in the East, these three individuals, Basil the Great, Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory of Nazianzus, they were known for their defense of the Orthodox position with regard to the whole controversy. I mentioned Ambrose of Milan. We'll run across him a little bit later. when we talk more about Augustine. Ambrose of Milan was just a phenomenal preacher. He was, you read often about men who are made leaders in the church, bishops in the church, who really aren't interested in the position, but for one reason or another are more or less forced into that position. Well, Ambrose was one of those. Ambrose was one of those who had no interest in any sort of position of authority. He was actually the governor of the city when it came time to elect a new bishop. And when they couldn't find anyone that they were all happy with, they were also happy with him as a governor that they elected him bishop instead. He didn't like the job, didn't want the job, but he took to it seriously once he was given that responsibility. And it's interesting to note that it was at that point, you see, this illustrates how much the church had changed in the first 350 years or so. It was at that point, once he was elected bishop, that he began to study theology, that he began to devote himself to some of the study that he expected would go along with his position, rightly expected. And we'll find that later when we talk about Martin Luther also. Martin Luther was actually a doctor of the Bible. He was a professor of the Bible before he spent any time studying the Bible. It was only after he had been in that position for a little while that he began to study the scriptures, had in his hands, made available to him the Greek New Testament that Erasmus had worked on, and began to study the scriptures in their original languages, that he came to some of the realizations he did. But here with Ambrose, we have one of those situations where he's made the bishop, he begins to study theology, he became then a leading theologian in the church. And John Chrysostom, just mentioned him very, very briefly. He was a great preacher who, one thing that is significant about Chrysostom is that even though he was made the bishop of Constantinople, the authorities in Constantinople, when they took exception to his message, they would run him out of town. And that, again, that's to illustrate that in the East primarily, theological issues were solved as often as not by civil decisions. And the direction the church went was governed as often as not by the direction that the civil authorities wanted it to go. And if they didn't like what the bishop was saying, if they didn't like what was being taught, run them out of town, bring somebody else in to teach something differently. In the East, what we'll find over the next couple of hundred years is that the authority of the church clearly in the East was secondary to the authority of the civil rulers. Now in the West, we're going to be talking about this over the course of this week and next week, in the West that evolved quite a bit differently, and we'll see how that worked out. Another name that you're familiar with, Jerome, perhaps his most monumental contribution to the church was his translation of the Bible into Latin. The Vulgate, as we've come to know it, was his work there, translating it directly from the Hebrew and the Greek into the Latin. Otherwise, he was a fairly controversial individual other than that, but we know him for that primarily. Well, let's move on to Augustine. As I said, I think Augustine marks the end of the church fathers, the beginning of the Middle Ages. And I apologize. Some folks pronounce his name Augustine. I've always pronounced it Augustine. So if I sound to you like I'm completely illiterate, I am, but I apologize if that pronunciation is bothersome. That's just the way I've always pronounced his name. Augustine, pardon? Bingo. I'm in good company. It works then.
Just call
him Augie. There you go, for short. Okay, just a little bit of background, a little bit of his personal background. He was born in North Africa, and this is, I've always been aware of this, but this is always, it just always seems odd to me how influential the church in North Africa was. Now, you don't think of the church even being virtually in existence in North Africa, with some exceptions. But during this time, during the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, the church in North Africa was tremendously vibrant, tremendously influential. It was growing and was very much, in some respects, the center of what was going on in the church. Well, he was born in North Africa in a town called Tagaste. He was born in 354 AD. So remember the timelines. Council of Nicaea was 325. So he was born about 30 years after the Council of Nicaea settled the Trinitarian controversy. He was growing up while it was still a major issue of discussion in the East. I would suggest that the Trinitarian controversy, as it was discussed in the East, was not for Augustine a big issue. Yes, he dealt with some of the issues, but that was not... He dealt with it differently. He didn't deal with it in quite the same way, with quite the same approach that it was being dealt with in the East. Well, he was unbelievably bright young man. He was sent very early on to Carthage. His father was a pagan, was not a believer in any way, shape, or form. His mother, whose name was Monica, she's fairly well known in church history. His mother was a devout believer and was one who, in some respects, pestered him for the rest of his life. Now, pestered him in a good way. He was very close to his mother, right to the end of her life. But she was the one who was always encouraging him to pursue Christianity, to try to understand what Christianity was all about. Always praying for him, always after him. Would even follow him as he lived in different cities in order to still encourage him in that. Well, the two of them, his mother and father, sent him to Carthage for his education. They weren't rich, but they recognized that he had some potential there, so they sent him there to study rhetoric. What he found in Carthage was not only a tremendous education, but he found all of the illicit and immoral pleasures that a city like that, a major city like that, had to offer. And this is a theme you'll see as you read Augustine, especially his confessions, as you learn something about his life, is he was a tremendously immoral young man, struggled with that all of his life. He had an illegitimate child when he was 18 years old. This is long before he became a believer. Had an illegitimate child when he was 18. She's referred to as his concubine. He stayed with her for many, many years. But it was always for him a struggle. He had a sense that he was really doing something wrong with his morality, with the decisions that he was making. And yet he, in some sense, felt as though he couldn't avoid it. He couldn't get himself out of those situations. So he lived a very wanton life. He had a son, Adeodatus was his son's name, who, interestingly enough, when Augustine became a Christian several years later, his son was baptized at the same time. So he stayed close to his son. His son died not too long after that, when he was still a very young man. But Augustine went to Carthage, gave himself to education, and gave himself to all of the immorality that could be found there in Carthage. He studied rhetoric, which for him, as he came to understand it, was pursuing more the art of convincing rather than pursuing what is true. That's the way he viewed rhetoric at that time. He read then one of Cicero's treatises called Hortensius. He read that and was convinced by Cicero, this is still before he was a believer, was convinced by Cicero that he needed to pursue truth. He needed to narrow down his search, if you will, not simply be concerned with the study of rhetoric and with education for the sake of education, but to pursue truth. So he gave himself to that. But at the same time, he still is struggling with his passions. Now, the reason I keep bringing that up is because I think we're going to see, I'm going to suggest to you a little bit later here in our discussion of Augustine, that had a profound influence on a lot of the things that he wrote about and a lot of the positions that he ended up taking. But let me read for you just another section out of his confessions with regard to how he dealt with these passions. This is out of Book 7, Chapter 7. Augustine says, "But now the more my heart warmed to these two men," he had talked about two men who had made some sacrifices, made some decisions to pursue what is true, to pursue Christianity. "Now as my heart warmed to these two men, and as I heard how they made the choice that was to save them by giving themselves entirely to your care," he's speaking to God here, "the more bitterly I hated myself in comparison with them. Many years of my life had passed, 12, unless I'm wrong, since I had heard Cicero's Hortensius at the age of 19, and it had inspired me to study philosophy. But I still postponed my renunciation of this world's joys, which would have left me free to look for that other happiness, the very search for which, let alone its discovery, I ought to have prized above the discovery of all human treasures and kingdoms, or the ability to enjoy all the pleasures of the body at a mere nod of the head. As a youth, I had been woefully at fault, particularly in early adolescence." And this is a famous line of Augustine's. You got to laugh when you hear this. "I'd been woefully at fault, particularly in early adolescence. I had prayed to you for chastity and said, 'God, give me chastity and continence, but not yet.'" He says, "For I was afraid that you would answer my prayer at once and cure me too soon of the disease of lust, which I wanted satisfied, not quelled. I had wandered on along the road of vice and the sacrilegious superstition of the Manichees, not because I thought that it was right, but because I preferred it to the Christian belief, which I did not explore as I ought, but opposed out of malice." Again, it's that he's just right out there with who he is, with what he thinks, with how he made his decisions. He makes that observation that he did not pursue. He says, "I prayed to God for chastity and for continence, but I didn't really want it. I wasn't ready to give up," he says, the lusts of the flesh and the things that he was pursuing. Well, that struggle, I think, again, shaped much of his thinking, much of his decisions. I think it was, at least to some degree, that struggle that led him into Manichaeism. Now, Manichaeism was a religious system. The founder, if you will, was an individual by the name of Mani, who lived over in Iran in the 2nd or 3rd century B.C., so he had lived 600-700 years before Augustine lived. And Manichaeism taught that there was this dualism, somewhat similar to some versions of Gnosticism. There was this dualism between the flesh and the spirit, between light and darkness. And the two were at war. The two were at battle. Well, Augustine heard that, and that resonated with him because of his own experience. That's what he felt and experienced in his own life day in and day out. So he began to pursue Manichaeism. He tells us in his confessions that he was a follower for about 9 years. During this time, he rejected Christianity. He overtly, consciously rejected Christianity, in part because of the claims that he saw it would make on him, as he talked about in the passage that we just looked at. He wasn't willing to give up some of the things that that he wanted to pursue. But he also, interestingly enough, he also rejected Christianity because Christianity as a philosophy and as a worldview just didn't sound as good to him as Manichaeism did. Manichaeism it seemed to him to hang together better. It was a more elegant system of thought. He didn't like, and I think that this is perhaps even a reflection of how he viewed himself. He didn't like seeing the Old Testament characters with all of their warts, with all of their foibles. He wanted to see things in just black and white terms, good and evil. He experienced in himself that struggle. He didn't like it when he saw that experience in Old Testament characters. He didn't like the idea that God would become a man, that God would take on the flesh, that was not an idea that was acceptable to him at all, because the flesh was dirty. The flesh was something to be avoided and something to be set aside. So he consciously rejected Christianity and embraced Manichaeism during this time for some of those reasons. Well, then he went off to Italy to study rhetoric, to teach rhetoric in Italy. While he was there, he went to hear Ambrose preach. We talked about Ambrose before. Ambrose was known as just a phenomenal preacher. And so Augustine thought, I'll go listen to him to pick up some pointers on public speaking. That was his reasoning there. He wanted to see how he spoke and to begin to learn some of his speaking techniques. Well, as he sat in on Ambrose preaching time after time, he became convinced of the truth of what Ambrose was preaching. And for Augustine, one thing that made the transition easier was that Ambrose tended to interpret, especially the Old Testament, he tended to interpret it very allegorically. And for Augustine at that time, that was helpful for him. That helped to make the transition from Manichaeism to Christianity, because he could set aside some of the crudeness and some of the roughness of the Old Testament and of what the scriptures had to say by interpreting those things allegorically rather than just accepting a lot of those accounts at face value. So for him, that made the transition a little bit easier. He continued to struggle, continued to do battle with his own passions, and finally gave himself over to Christianity. And I don't remember exactly what date that was, exactly when that was in his life, but by this time, he's probably in his 30s at this point. Now, I want to transition into talking a little bit about Ambrose, or about Augustine's influence, because as a church father, if you will, as a personality within the church, there are few people more influential in the Catholic Church and even having such tremendous influence in the Protestant Reformation, few people that have much more influence than does Augustine. And so I want to talk just a little bit about some of his views, some of his positions on a couple of different things, some of the theological battles that he fought. But before doing that, I think Augustine is a great illustration of something that we've always seen within the church, and I would suggest we always will see, and that is you can have someone like Augustine who holds certain positions, who teaches certain things, and as he is teaching those things, as he holds those positions, he has nuances to what he believes and what he's teaching that he understands and that he tries to express, but that are sometimes missed by succeeding generations. What I want to say by that is that a lot of what Augustine said and did, I would suggest, was misconstrued by succeeding generations, taken out of context. A lot of the subtlety of his message, a lot of the nuances were missed, and a lot of the times that Augustine was willing to speculate about things, we talked about this we talked about this last week with regard to other folks, Augustine was willing to speculate about some things, and other people would take some of those speculations and would try to reduce those to church doctrine or church dogma. Well, thus we have, and here's where you'll find me defensive of Augustine. I'm not foolish enough to accept or to suggest that he was always right in all that he said, all that he did, but it's not at all uncommon to find with Augustine that some of the people who looked at him as the source of their ideas were in fact misconstruing, misunderstanding, missing some of the subtleties and the nuances of what he was trying to say. The other thing I think goes on, the other thing that went on with Augustine, I think it still goes on with Bible teachers today, is there were times that Augustine was asked to respond to certain questions, certain issues, and by responding to those things, he would be in a position where he would be saying something that for him wouldn't even necessarily be a position that was all that important to him. But in order to respond to questions that were raised, in order to try to flesh out his positions on things, he would end up stating something that wasn't that important a point to him, would require for him a lot more fine-tuning and a lot more refining before he would really pound on the pulpit with regard to a point like that. But having done that, having said those things, having put them in print, those are some of the very things that later on then were misconstrued and misunderstood. And I would suggest that that happens to anyone who's a biblical teacher, even in this day and age. I would suggest that that happens with Jack, not uncommonly, that in response to a question, he might very well, or anyone might very well, say something that, out of context, without the background, without fleshing it out some more, can be taken the wrong way. Well, that happened with Augustine, I believe. Well, let me talk about a couple of battles that Augustine fought, theological battles I'm referring to here. The first one was with regard to Donatism. We mentioned this briefly over the last couple of weeks. Donatus was a bishop of Carthage about 30, 40, 50 years earlier. He was a bishop who took the position that those church leaders who had turned away from the faith, this would have been quite a bit earlier because this was even back during the time of the persecutions. Donatus lived from 313 to 355. He took the position that if an individual had turned away from the faith in any way, shape, or form, basically they were not welcome back into the church. And there was a huge problem with church leaders, elders of the church, bishops of the church, a huge problem with those individuals who had apostatized. Because, see if you can get the picture here, imagine that the bishop of some town has become an apostate. He's turned away from the faith in the face of persecution. But you have in that church elders that were ordained by that bishop. You have an entire congregation that was trained by that bishop, that received their instruction from that bishop, that were confirmed in the faith. There was a whole process that folks went through in the church in those days in order to become full-fledged members of the church. Training, there were traditions, rituals that went on, all that sort of thing. Well, imagine if you find yourself in the position where the bishop who took you through that process, or the bishop who ordained the elders, or the ordained perhaps another bishop who had taken you through that process, turns out to be an apostate. In their way of thinking, what they were suggesting was that that would then nullify any spiritual activity, any good that had come as part of that ministry. The sacraments that they had offered were invalid. The training that they had offered, that was the position of the Donatists during this time, unless the clergy, unless the folks that were involved in leadership, unless they were themselves completely pure, then there was something invalid to their ministry. And that would invalidate the conversion of individuals in the church, their training, their growth, their maturity, all those sorts of things. You can see the picture of the problem there. Well, Augustine, in response to that, basically was holding to the position that the activity that they were engaged in and the things that they were doing and the role that they had in the church was not dependent upon their own personal sanctity. It wasn't dependent upon their own personal goodness. Augustine's position was that it was God who was the one who was behind those activities, and to the degree that God was active in the training of someone who was coming into the faith, or to the degree that God was active in growing up a congregation or in ordaining elders, bishops, that sort of thing, to the degree that God was active in doing that as part of what was going on in the church, those activities were valid, as opposed to the Donatists, who were willing to invalidate all those activities. Well, I think Augustine's position came from, at least in, to some degree, came from a recognition of his own struggles. He himself would be the first to recognize the battle raging within himself with regard to sin. He would be the first one to acknowledge that it's foolish to think that bishops, that elders within the church, that any individuals within the church are going to live the sort of pure lives that the Donatists seem to be insisting on. So I would suggest that Augustine's position was one simply of recognizing what's going on with humanity, what's going on with the sin that even believers struggle with. But what happened then later on in the history of the church is that his position on that, the things he talked about, the teaching that that he gave on that, was morphed over the years into the position that somehow or other, inherent in the church as an organization, was this authority. And inherent within the church and within their rituals and within the things that they did, there was some inherent spiritual power that went along with those things. Well, that wasn't what Augustine was trying to say. He was trying to simply inject into the conversation a recognition of what it's like when fallen humans, when sinful humans are involved in the church and are involved in ministry. And what that was changed into was the idea that the church itself has authority inherent simply in being the church. And that, as we will see later on in the Middle Ages, that became a huge issue in the Middle Ages, when we find eventually that in the church and with the leaders, with many of the leaders of the church, the bishops, the archbishops, the popes, there was no morality whatsoever. They had taken that to the furthest extreme, that somehow or other, by holding the office, there was some spiritual authority there, and that had absolutely no bearing on their lives as individuals. Well, another battle that Augustine fought during this time was with Pelagius, and this was one of the more famous theological struggles that he had. Pelagius was a monk from Great Britain who... Gonzalez tells us, quote from Gonzalez, he says that Pelagius saw the Christian life as a constant effort through which one's sins could be overcome and salvation attained. Basically, it's sort of a different look at, a different form of the same kind of struggle. Pelagius was saying that by our will, by our choices, we have the ability... God saves us, but from that point on, it's up to us to live good lives, was what Pelagius was teaching. And he was adamant about that. His teaching became very widespread in the empire during this period of time. And it was Augustine then who had to step into the fray and had to again talk about the sinfulness of man, talk about man's inability on his own to live a righteous life, to live a good life. He stepped into that, and it was, again, later on, a lot of his teaching in this matter, a lot of his teaching in this whole discussion that was morphed into a view of a very restrictive view, if you will, of original sin. As he talked about how pervasive sin was, and he was... Exhibit A of how pervasive sin was, as he talked about that and he reflected on it biblically, that later on, without the nuance and without the subtlety, was morphed into a medieval tradition and a church tradition of the depravity of man and of the sinful nature that went beyond what Augustine himself intended. So that's just a little bit about Augustine. Two of his most significant books were his Confessions that I've read a little bit from. The City of God was written at a very interesting time in the history of the empire. He was in North Africa when, in 410, when the barbarian tribes, I think it was the Goths, I'm trying to remember just who it was, were knocking on the door of Rome. Rome was sacked in 410. Now for us, that's a date we've heard of in history, doesn't mean a whole lot to us, but imagine what that meant for the Western world at that point, because Rome had been around in their minds for over 1,000 years by this time. It had been the ruler of the world for hundreds of years and had just been declining bit by bit as Constantine went to the east, as he left a power vacuum in the west. It had been declining, but when Rome was actually sacked in 410, that shook the Western world to its very foundation, because if this city could be sacked by the barbarians, what could stand? Well, it was in response, at least in part, to that event that he wrote The City of God, which is dealing with the whole question of comparing the city of God to the city of man. And how does God view those two entities, and what's the difference between the two? That brings us to the end of Augustine. He died in 430 AD. Interestingly enough, again, he's in North Africa. Rome was sacked in 410. By 430 AD, the Vandals, rightly named, the Vandals were a barbarian tribe from way up in Northern Europe. They were up from up in the Scandinavian countries. They had found their way down through the Iberian Peninsula, down through Spain, across the Straits of Gibraltar, and across North Africa. And by 430 AD, it was the Vandals who had sacked Carthage, and in the process had sacked Hippo as well. Augustine was the bishop of Hippo at this time. So by the end of his life, the Roman Empire, as it had been known for hundreds and hundreds of years, was pretty much in complete disarray by this time. Well, that's the end of the story of the church fathers. We're going to move into a discussion of the church in the Middle Ages. And you're going to have to, one of the reasons I wanted to give you the outline, because as we're talking about the church in the Middle Ages, what we're going to do is we're going to follow one theme for several hundred years, and then we're going to go back and pick up another theme, follow that for several hundred years. So we're not going to be doing this all in chronological order. We're going to be doing this thematically for the next little while. And I wanted to give you the outline, hopefully with enough dates on the outline so that you can, as you think it through, you can kind of match up the dates with the different themes that we're picking up and discussing as we go through here. Well, as we talk about the church in the Middle Ages, I want to talk about, first of all, the political context is the way I phrase it, and that is that we're really seeing, by the end of the 4th century, we're really seeing a very clear split between the empire in the east and the empire in the west, as well as a split between the church in the east and the church in the west. So by this time, much more clearly, we're seeing that division widening. And again, just going back to pick up the dates, Constantine when he became emperor, he moved the capital to the east, to what became known as Constantinople, from Rome. This was in the early 300s. And when he moved his capital to the east, needless to say, that left a huge power vacuum in the west. The civil ruler was gone, the civil authority was gone. What began to happen was, as the barbarian tribes would begin to invade parts of the Roman Empire during this time, there wasn't anybody there to stand against them. The emperor, if he had enough power at a given time, if he had enough troops available, might from time to time come and try and help out in the west, but generally speaking, more and more, the emperor stayed in the east and left the west to take care of itself, to fend for itself over time. Now, as you're thinking about this, realize that the barbarians, we've got this picture of the barbarian tribes that has some inaccuracies. It's been suggested that the barbarians, as much as anything else, wanted into the Roman Empire because they saw what the Roman Empire had to offer. It wasn't that they wanted to destroy it. They saw the commerce. They saw the society. They saw much that was to be admired as being advantageous over what their own culture had to offer. And so in some respects, the barbarians just wanted a piece of it. They didn't want to destroy it as much as they wanted a piece of it. They wanted to be a part of it. Well, again, some dates, 410 AD, it was the Visigoths that sacked Rome. They kept going and occupied Spain for a while. The Vandals came down from Scandinavia, went over to North Africa. It's interesting because if you look up a map, and I tried to figure out a way to print a map and get it to everybody, but if you look at a map, the Vandals went down through Spain, across the Straits of Gibraltar, across North Africa, and then hopped back into the Mediterranean Sea and took Sicily as well. So the Vandals, they found themselves a long ways from home and were there for quite a while, really until the Muslims pushed them out a couple of hundred years later. The Vandals were in control of much of North Africa and much of the Mediterranean. The Franks occupied much of what is now modern-day France. The Saxons were up in northern Europe. The Saxons crossed over into the southern part of what is now England. Interestingly enough, the barbarians, as they were called, were often Christians because even in the early years of the church, we really didn't talk about missionary activity in the first couple of hundred years, but even in the early years of the church, Christianity had spread to the northern part of Europe. Now, they were Christians, but for the most part, they were Arian. They had been converted by Arian preachers. Arianism had been much more, as I indicated, had been much more influential in many respects than we think of. And so a lot of the barbarians were Arian. And what we found, what you find over the next several hundred years, is that as they began to invade the West, again, my take on what I read in history was the whole Trinitarian controversy was not a big enough issue to them to fight over. So as they invaded the West, they would as they would sit down and they would begin to assimilate into the culture of the West, they were just as happy to embrace orthodoxy, quote unquote, with regard to the Trinitarian position, as they were Arianism. They didn't seem to mind giving up Arianism. It wasn't that big a deal for them. Well, we have this going on with the barbarians in the Eastern Empire. The empire remains intact as a political entity. Every once in a while, it would sort of consolidate itself, and there'd be a powerful enough emperor that they would make a move back to the east or back to the west to try and reunite the empire. The consciousness was that it was all still one empire, from Spain to east of Constantinople and North Africa. The idea was that it was all still one empire. So every once in a while, an emperor would go back and try to consolidate his position in the West. But for the most part, they just didn't have the authority, the manpower, the political force to be able to do that. 7th and 8th centuries, it became obvious that the Eastern Empire really was not going to be able to protect Rome. And so by this time, 500, 600, 700 AD, by this time, it was the bishops of Rome, and in a little while later in this lecture, either today or next week, we'll be talking about the rise of the papacy. Well, it was the bishops of Rome who filled some of the power vacuum in the West. And what's interesting was their authority did not come primarily as a spiritual authority. It wasn't that they gained their position of influence and prestige primarily because of their spiritual role, their spiritual maturity. Rather, it was the power vacuum left by the emperor being in the East. And so when it came time to deal with one of the best examples was one of the bishops of Rome, Leo, I can't remember which Leo it was, but one of the bishops of Rome, when Attila the Hun was about to come in and sack and destroy Rome. It was the bishop who went out and negotiated with Attila. There was no civil ruler there to have that role. There was no army there to fight him. So it was the bishop of Rome who basically went out and sued for peace, if you will, to keep the city from being destroyed. And it was at that point then that the bishop of Rome gained tremendous influence, because now he's beginning to take the role of a civil ruler as well as a spiritual authority in the church. Well, now I'm going to jump back to the outline here. About the same time, we have the rise of Islam. And let me just give you some dates there that you can hang your hat on. Muhammad fled from Mecca in 622 AD. So again, fix your dates there. Constantine was the early 300s AD. Augustine he died in 430 AD in North Africa. Muhammad fled from Mecca in 622 AD. And he fled from Mecca because his monotheistic teaching was in contrast to that of the tribes around him. And so he basically had to flee for his life at that time. Well, his religious system drew on Judaism. It drew on Christianity. He claimed that his beliefs, that his teaching was inspired by a revelation from the angel Gabriel. To him, Jesus was a prophet, not divine, but was a prophet. He incorporated elements of Christianity and Judaism. But for him, God demanded obedience above all else. That was one of his primary tenets of his teaching. Well, over the next 10 years, 622 till his death in 632, he undertook several military campaigns against neighboring Arab tribes. He converted most of what is Arabia. He converted most of that area to Islam by force. It was by military force that he was conquering the tribes around him, converting them to his religion. It really is remarkable to see what happened militarily with Islam over the next couple of hundred years. Muhammad died in 632. Very soon after that, in the next 10 years, his successors waged campaigns elsewhere. They took Jerusalem in 638. They took Alexandria in 642. I had mentioned last week that Alexandria had become certainly the intellectual capital of the world at that point, in many respects the spiritual capital. And here, and there had been some, obviously there had been some changes, some decline in the ensuing years, but here by 642, Alexandria has fallen to the Muslims. They continued west, picture North Africa. They continued west along the Mediterranean, conquering all of North Africa. And then they also conquered to the east, conquering what was then the Persian Empire. By 711, this is now 90 years after Muhammad first fled from Mecca, by 711, they crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and basically overran the Visigoths, who were the ones who had occupied most of Spain by this time. They overran the Visigoths, and they ruled over most of Spain for several hundred years. So that is sometimes lost on us, that in the early years, the first 100 years of Islam, they had taken all of North Africa, they had taken much of the Middle East, they'd overrun the Persian Empire at this time. They'd gone right up into Europe. They were only stopped in Europe by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours. This is another one of those names you got to love. It was Charles the Hammer Martel that stopped the spread of Islam in Spain at this time. That was in 732, rather. But they had now taken much of what had made up the Roman Empire. And again, keep in mind that in the early years of the church, the churches that were most influential were going to be the churches at Antioch, the very early years, the churches at Antioch and at Jerusalem. Later on, it would be the churches at Alexandria, the churches at Carthage, the churches there along North Africa. And here we have, by 700 AD, we have all of those cities, all of those churches then, but the cities being overrun by Islam. So again, there's a huge vacuum that allows the church in Rome and the bishop of the church in Rome to have much more prestige. The bishop of, we'll talk about this in a little while, the development of the papacy, but Islam played a major role in allowing power to consolidate in Rome during this time. Well, we'll get back to to what happened with the spread of Islam a little bit later, but moving on in our discussion of the two empires, the two churches, there were theological controversies. In the East, there was a virtually a nonstop controversy with regard to the nature of the Trinity. They just kept fighting the same battles. They kept going over the same things for hundreds of years, the person and the nature of Jesus. What seems to me to be clear from the accounts that I have read is there was a whole lot of heat going on in those discussions and not a lot of light. I mean, there just didn't seem to be a lot of clarity, a lot of new ideas that were coming out of that. Well, in the West, even though the church in the West was not very well represented at the Council of Nicaea in 325, the Orthodox view, the Nicene view, seemed to be accepted rather passively in the West. And again, what I am suggesting is that the battles over the Trinity were not fought in the West in the same way, with the same intensity, for the same amount of time that they were in the East. There was an earlier acceptance of the Orthodox position, and it just wasn't nearly as big an issue in the West. Well, in the East, continual questioning, all sorts of intrigue, political maneuvering. The civil authorities are always having to intervene in the church to settle matters and to get them back on track theologically. I'm going to jump forward now to the event that marked the final split between the churches in the East and the West. This came in 1054. So imagine now we're yet a few hundred years further down the road. But in 1054, by this time, the church in the West was well established. The Pope, as he had come to be known, had really settled for a couple of hundred years, had settled into his position as the leader of the Church of the West. When we talk about the papacy, I guess I should just mention, the Pope was not, the Bishop of Rome, was not recognized as the head of the church, the undisputed head of the church, for several hundred years. It really was not until 400, 500, 600 AD that the Pope was really recognized, even in the West, as the head of the Western Church. But by 1054, the Pope clearly had that role. The Western Church had theologically, in a sense, retreated to a simpler theological position. The Apostles' Creed was a formulation that they were comfortable with. They weren't quite as concerned with all the fine points and all the squabbling that was going on with the church in the East, but they began to become concerned with other issues, with the celibacy of the clergy, with the role of the state within the church. They began to become concerned with those issues. But what happened was, in the West, the church in the West decided to insert a word into the Nicene Creed. When they used the Nicene Creed, they inserted the word filioque, a Latin word, to describe the fact that, in their view, the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, filioque, and from the Son. Well, now this will give you some idea of, in my mind, the minutiae that they got involved with. In the West, them's fighting words. You don't say that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, because in the East, thank you. Yes, in the East, that's my editor here. In the East, them's fighting words, because everybody knows that the Holy Spirit doesn't proceed from the Father and the Son, but that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father through the Son. And if you're going to suggest that it's from the Father and the Son rather than through the Son, well, we can't have anything to do with each other. So you have the church in the East, you have the church in the West going to battle over this this change in the Nicene Creed. The Pope in the East, or the Pope in the West, rather, Pope Leo X sent a cardinal, Cardinal Humbert, to the West. And as you could almost guess from the name, Cardinal Humbert wasn't an easy guy to get along with. He went to the East, and rather than working at trying to understand Greek culture, trying to understand some of the differences there, he didn't bother to try to learn the language. He didn't bother to try and fit in at all. He came to the East, to the church in Constantinople, and pronounced to them that they needed to make changes in the way they did things. They needed to begin to make sure that the clergy was celibate. They were all married in the West, or in the East. So you come along from the Bishop of Rome and you tell the entire church in the East that it's time for them to embrace celibacy. That doesn't go over very well. You come to the East and you tell the church in the East that they spend too much time, they allow the civil authorities to exert too much influence. That doesn't go over very well. So Cardinal Humbert comes along in 1054 with the goal of trying to unite the two churches again, and instead he completely alienates the church in the East. At one point, he gets so fed up with all that's going on that he marches into to St. Sophia, which is a church in Constantinople that was the primary church in the city at that time, as the patriarch, which was basically like the Pope in the East, as the patriarch, whose name was Michael Cerularius, as the patriarch was celebrating the Mass. This is on June 16th, 1054. Humbert comes in, interrupted the celebration of communion, excommunicated the patriarch and all of the believers in the East. He pronounced an excommunication on all of them in the name of Pope Leo X, who, unbeknownst to any of them, had died a few days earlier. So you have Cardinal Humbert coming, and instead of trying to patch things up, completely alienates the church, anathematizes, excommunicates the entire Eastern church from the top on down in the name of a pope who isn't even alive anymore. And with that, he marched back to Rome. Well, that, needless to say, solidified the split in the church between the East and the West in 1054. Yes?
Well, where did the celibacy thing come from?
Well, we'll see that as we're, in a little while, we're going to be talking about developments within the church. We're going to be talking about monasticism, the rise of the papacy. We're going to be talking about some of those things. There are a lot of reasons, and we'll be getting to those here a little bit later today or next week. Okay, finishing up our discussion here of the two empires. Now we're going to go back a couple hundred years in the West. The Eastern, by 600-800 AD, the emperor in the East no longer even tried to have any influence in the West. So you have the church, the bishops, and you have the civil authorities turning more and more to the rulers, the civil authorities, from amongst the barbarian tribes who have now settled in and assimilated and become a part of the culture, become a part of the empire there. Well, the religious issues were not big deals there. Just to give you some specific dates, the last emperor who really had any real authority in the West was the Emperor Romulus Augustulus, who had been deposed in 476 AD. So for now, 400 years, about 300 years by this time, there really was not a unifying political figure in the West. Well, Charles Martel, I had mentioned a little bit ago, Charles the Hammer Martel, I love these names. He had been the one who stopped the Muslims at Tours in 732. Now, how would you like to have been Charles Martel's son? Charles Martel was Pepin the Short. your dad's the hammer and you're the short. I mean, how's that to try and live up to that? But Pepin, actually, Martel and Pepin were not kings. They actually had a position of authority in the household of the king at that time, and the kings, the Frankish kings, were very weak rulers at that time. So what Pepin the Short did was he went to the Pope at that time. The Pope was, don't have the Pope's name here, but he went to the Pope at that time, and he got the Pope to allow him to depose the Frankish king, whose name was Childeric the Stupid. That's the best of the bunch. That's the best name of the whole bunch. So Charles Martel stops the spread of Islam. Pepin the Short consolidates things, gets the Pope to allow him to pose Childeric the Stupid. And it was shortly after that then that Pepin the Short's son was Charlemagne. So we'll be talking about Charlemagne here some more in a little while. But what you're seeing there, what you're seeing is that with the emperors in the East no longer exercising any real authority in the West, others step in to fill the vacuum. And we'll be talking about the papacy here in a little bit about that as well. Do you have a question, comment?
Well, the kings you're talking about.
Hang on. Let me just look at my outline, see if we're going to... Well, we're two pages into this lecture. Let me see if we... At this point, why don't we just go ahead and... Well, we're going to break for questions here, but let me just make one other... Just wrap up with one other story here that is a theme that we're going to get into here in a little bit. Charlemagne was crowned Roman Emperor. They still maintain the name. Later on, a few hundred years later, it would be known as the Holy Roman Empire. But Charlemagne was crowned the Roman Emperor on Christmas Day in 800 AD. Now, another interesting, odd little story that is going to reflect the fact that one of the themes we're going to pick up is going to be the struggle between church and state and the struggle for authority, because in the East, the civil authority was the ultimate authority. In the West, it became a huge struggle as to whether the Pope and the church held ultimate authority or whether the civil rulers did. And we're going to talk about that extensively over the next week or two. But you see the beginnings of this struggle because it was Pope Leo III, who was there for Charlemagne's coronation. And by tradition, here's the way that went. Charlemagne is getting ready to be crowned, basically Roman Emperor at this point, and he leans down to tie his shoe or something like that, and the Pope quickly puts the crown on his head, basically to illustrate the fact that his authority comes from the Pope. That's the dynamic that was going on there. That was the struggle that was beginning to happen there. The struggle was, is it the Pope that has ultimate authority, or is it the emperor? So when Charlemagne wasn't looking, Pope Leo III put the crown on his head, at which point Charlemagne took it off and then recrowned himself. Well, that just gives us a picture, gives us a little foretaste, if you will, of what we're going to see over the next several hundred years of the struggle between the church and state. Okay, let me open it up for questions, and you have to use the mic.
Well, I just wanted to kind of fill in some blanks. Excuse me. The kings you were talking about under Charles the Bold and Pippin, they were the Merovingians. And the title that Pepin had was called the Mayor. And that's kind of how
he was the mayor domo. He was the chief of the house.
Right, yeah. Yeah, because the Merovingians, well, I won't get into their theology, but they had become weak. And then with Islam, what I had read, that one of the reasons why they kept conquering is because the Berbers and some of these raiding parties that they enlisted to help them take over these cities, they had to keep them busy. And so basically, to kind of keep them occupied with something, they kept invading until they were finally stopped. And that's why the jihad is not part of the original tenets of Islam, but it became convenient to make it so.
Hmm. Augustine, the stuff that you read from him, sounded like he thought that even the exercise of sexuality within marriage was an inferior state. Am I picking up something wrong?
He certainly did think that at one point. I have not read enough further to know where he landed on that. But certainly early in his life, there was the very real struggle with the idea of whether or not sexual activity was allowable for anybody. So, I mean, whether there was something base, something dirty, something evil about that.
Yeah. You're going to talk about the rise of the idea of celibacy as being a superior state, and I just wondered to what degree his struggles or his wondering about that may have contributed to the rise of celibacy. Like, why didn't he marry his concubine? I mean, if he lived with her for several years, it sounds like he's thinking that, that would permanently entrench him in sin if he married her.
And I should be better informed about that. I'm not. He behaved badly with regard to his concubine in that when he finally settled in his mind his commitments, he basically set her aside without a word. I mean, he continued to take care of his son. I don't know if he made any sort of financial provisions for her or not, but I mean, this woman that had been the mother of his child and been a part of his, even in the stuff that he writes about his life with her, you really do get the impression from his writing that he feels dirty, if you will, by being in a relationship with her. So I won't defend him on that. That seems to have been a...
I wondered if that was an influence of Manichaeism.
Well, certainly it was.
And isn't that sort of a characteristic of Platonic thought, too, and the Neoplatonism that... ended up influencing or sort of almost becoming part of the church?
Absolutely. And I'm going to suggest when we talk about monasticism here in the next week or two, it certainly was pervasive in the church, the idea that somehow or other we needed to mortify the flesh, we needed to... I mean, there was a lot of that thinking that pervaded even the church.
One of the, just when you're talking about Charlemagne, and this is something that I've read about having to do with the style of worship and my interest in music and that sort of thing, that around 800 AD, 900, music gets written down, but the main, in the church in the West, I'm not sure what the history of the church in the East is. Music also is written down about that time, and before that, scholars can't seem to find manuscripts before, I don't know, that's what I understand. But the question being, and I wanted to ask you, was, It was intended to standardize the mass or worship from Rome all across the empire in the West. Mm-hmm. Was that the reason for doing it all in the same way? Was to try to stay in control?
For doing what all in the same way?
Of the mass. It had to be the same in the far western part of the British Isles as it was in Rome. So what you did, the idea was to write music down, worship in the same fashion everywhere. Is that is that what they were trying to do, the popes in Rome, to consolidate power?
Yeah, certainly. And as we talked about the development of the papacy, the church, there certainly was a movement, conscious for some, I mean, subconscious in many ways, certainly was a movement to standardize things, to make things normative throughout the church in Western Europe at this time. music, the celebration of the sacraments, actually putting in writing what that was all about. That was all a part of what was going on in the development of the church at that time.
As well as the church calendar, where you...
Sure, you bet. Yep, yeah, all those things were going on.
And how were they different before, do we know?
Well, before there was much more, everything was much more localized. You didn't have things quite as centralized. You didn't have a central authority. For many years, different bishops in different cities had greater authority, greater influence than did the Bishop of Rome. And the influence tended to be not because of their position, what city they were in, as much as because of their personal character. So the churches had much more distinctive, much more localized, individualistic sort of flavor to them than they came to have later on. By the time we get into 600-700, we're seeing the papacy begin to exert its authority over the entire church in the West, and all of this begins to be more standardized.
Okay. So, and you'll probably address this later on, and then I'll release the Mac, but the Mass, the Western mm-hmm. Mass, as we know it, or the Mass, the so-called Eastern Orthodox Church, when did that become standardized?
I don't know. Mm. I mean, there are elements of it that we'll talk about a little bit later, when certain elements of it became, and elements of church dogma and that sort of thing became, or came into widespread acceptance. But when the Mass, as we know it now, became widely accepted, I just am not sure. I'll have to look into that some more.
As you develop the difference between the Eastern and Western philosophies, could you go back a little bit further, remind me of the Arian position and the Orthodox position, and then I think that'll help
sure.
you put it together to why the differences develop.
Basically, the Arian position was that Jesus was less than... Jesus, as Jack observed last week, Jesus was really important, was really a critical figure for Arius and for the Arians, but he did not have the same level, if you will, of divinity. There was some question as to whether or not he was in fact divine, whether he was co-eternal, all those sorts of things. It was the struggle with this whole issue, and this is what I tried to bring up a couple weeks ago, trying to come to grips with this whole issue of, what does it mean that God entered into the world? In what way did he enter the world? Was that a man? Was that God? Was that some sort of strange hybrid? But for the Arians, he was less than divine in the same way that God the Father was. And that was what had to be settled then at the Council of Nicaea, that God the Father, Jesus, the Holy Spirit were basically of the same substance, that's the wording that was used, the same essence, the same substance as each other, as God the Father, but different persona, different persons. From there it just got really tricky trying to flesh out just what that meant.
The orthodox side was the latter that you just depicted,
yes.
And that's why at the Council of Nicaea, the difficulty developed.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's where it had developed a few years earlier in Alexandria, but that was the attempt to settle it. And it was, I would suggest that the attempt to settle it was primarily because Constantine didn't want to have a huge theological squabble splitting up the empire when he was doing his best to unify the empire. So, yep. Any other questions?
In the Apostles' Creed, was before the Nicene Creed, right?
Mm-hmm. Apostles' Creed wasn't formulated by council. It just sort of generally came into acceptance around 150, probably in the West, okay. Much simpler.
And do both of them, in their English versions, include the phrase, one holy Catholic and apostolic church?
If I stopped and tried to, I could probably repeat the Apostles' Creed. It almost certainly refers to the Catholic Church, but Catholic in a different sense.
Meaning universal.
Yes.
It all of a sudden occurred to me that if the Catholic Church, meaning you know, Pope and nuns and priests and liturgy and all this kind of thing didn't really exist at that point, then at some point when it started to exist, somebody must have made the decision to say, we're that church that's talking about, and then the word that we translate Catholic must yep. have.
That's you've hit the nail on the head. Catholic Church in the Apostles' Creed simply meant universal, but the church later appropriated that and said, that's us. We're the ones that are the universal church.
So that's what, when everybody says the Nicene Creed, you're pledging allegiance to us, not saying that there's there is a universal church, there is one body of Christ.
Well, that's what it came to
right.
mean to the
right.
poorly informed, if you will.
Right.